Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, which means we take some time to dive deeper beneath the headlines of the big story of the week. And this week, it was tragic.
It started around 2:30 Saturday afternoon in the parking lot of this Tops Friendly Market store in a predominantly black neighborhood in Buffalo.
Next thing you know, you just kept hearing boom, boom, boom. And you hear them coming inside the store. And all we could do was just drop to the ground.
As more details emerged, it became clear the attack was not random, but thoroughly planned and motivated by hate.
Just before heading to the market, he's believed to have written and posted a 180-page statement, proudly labeling himself a white supremacist and outlining the attack.
Understandably, the community is still reeling.
People just wake up and come kill us whenever they feel like it, and that's not okay!
Sound there from NBC News and CNN. President Biden tried to deliver some hope while speaking in Buffalo on Tuesday.
In America, evil will not win, I promise you. Hate will not prevail. And white supremacy will not have the last word.
Here in Boston, emotions hit hard. Here's how Reverend Rulli Bodrick II, senior pastor at the 12th Baptist Church, talked about the tragedy with his congregation.
As I told him Sunday, we're grappling with our faith and our frustrations. How do you manage those moments? How do you deal with those times? How do you process the trauma, whether near or far? How do you grapple with the fact that we no longer have safe spaces?
How do you do that? And how do you do it here? Here in our greater Boston community, here to help us grapple with that, two folks who've been a part of life in Boston for a long time and know our community well. Tito Jackson is a former Boston City Councilor, CEO and founder of Apex Noir Cannabis, and as of yesterday, one of the inaugural members of the new Boston Commission on Black Men and Boys. Tito, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Joan Vanacki, assistant editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. Joan wrote a piece this week with the headline, "How many white Americans will do anything more than shake their heads about the Buffalo Massacre?" Joan, thanks for coming in as
well. Thanks for asking me.
I appreciate it. So I want to start with the where were you question, Tito. Where were you and what were you thinking when you first heard the news?
Just with my nephew. This phrase, "this is not who we are," is the antithesis of what is happening. This is who we are as a country. This actually happened multiple times. It's also frustrating to me that the descriptions of white assailants are usually to give their background and how nice or quiet they were in school and whether or not people picked on them or not. It pissed me off. It just made me very, very angry. As a black person in this country, the things that actually continue to happen to us in our communities, in particular in this case where this is targeted, this individual knew the demographic data in order to drive across the country, live stream this. And the first pieces people begin to talk about are his mental health. And I guess the last piece is he was unharmed, unblemished. And you had a police officer who had his arm on his kind of right shoulder. And I just think about the number of black folk who've been shot in the back in traffic stops. Breonna Taylor, who was sleeping. And just the number of black folks who die time and time again at the hands of police, and this individual who killed 10 people literally had not a blemish on him.
Tito, I want to underscore what you're saying before I come to you, Joan. Reverend Bodrick was in on Wednesday. He was here for a leadership conversation. We're doing a series called Stepping Up, where we're talking about people who make change in their community. But we started in this place, and I asked him the question about what he was thinking and feeling on Saturday, and I want to play that.
To be very honest with you, I was very angry this weekend, frustrated, but also angered, because we've seen the signs of this type of white supremacist violence and ideology not only be perpetuated, but end up with lives lost. And if you put it in the grander context of American history, this isn't a new thing. It's just new in its form here in our particular context.
So, Joan, it was really striking to me to then read your piece on what I might call the Great White American Shrug. So I want to ask you where you were when you heard the news and what made you decide to – I mean, you can write about anything.
Right. I had spent the afternoon helping my son. I was doing some babysitting for him, and because he's working on a house in New Hampshire. And I saw it on Twitter first, and when I got home, I did what I would normally do. I turned on CNN, and I happened to tune in just when they were doing the press conference with the usual lineup of officials talking about what had happened and responding to questions from the press. And I felt, my first reaction was that this was disgusting and disturbing, and it felt like a kick in the gut. But my second instinct was to turn it off, that I felt like I had seen this, heard this before, and I knew exactly the script that was going to follow. I knew exactly what the officials were going to say. I knew exactly what was going to happen, what Tito described, who the assailant was, you know, the background, the story about how he got the gun. I knew what the talking heads were going to say. And I sort of stood there and said to myself, I'm not going to write about it. Because my deadline is Monday morning, I usually spend a part of the weekend trying to figure out what I'm going to write about. And I just thought, I'm not going to write about it because there's nothing more that I could say. And I often feel now that I'm not the right person to say it anyway. That changed as the weekend went on. I started to feel, why am I avoiding this? Why don't I want to think about it? And maybe I should just sort of write about my own reaction. And what really made me write about it was the piece in the New York Times where I saw this bishop from Buffalo who sort of exhorted his fellow religious leaders and said, if you don't stand up and say something, you're not my friend. We need you to speak out about it. And I thought he was letting the rest of us off the hook in a way, and that I would try to write about it, and that in a way I was kind of tracking my own reaction. Maybe the headline should have been memo to myself, or maybe Tito would have put the headline white people problems. I don't know, but I decided to give it a try.
So Tito, I'm just, people can't see the connection, the eye contact between the two of you, the way you were physically reacting while Joan was speaking. So I'm just going to let you jump in.
I want to thank Joan for using her big voice, and she is one of the most prolific columnists that we have in the city of Boston. But I reflect on, and we're at BU right now, I reflect on one of the graduates here, MLK, and he said, in the end, we will not remember the words of our enemy, but the silence of our friends. In the end, we will not remember the words of our enemy, but the silence of our friends. We have to, and I implore you, as white folks, to step up and have these conversations. I am not in at your Thanksgiving table, your birthday party, and someone as amazingly inspirational as Willie Broderick is not there. On a regular basis, these conversations, you know, this young man, had he been Muslim, we would have asked, what cell did he come from? Mm. Where was he radicalized? Right? Well, this is a young white gentleman who, in this case, came from someplace. He came from a family. He came from a community and the like. And so we have to really begin to think about 3 out of 4 of the domestic terrorist acts come from right-wing extremists. We need to look at this in historic context. This is the worst massacre since Tulsa, Oklahoma, of black folk in the United States. And I saw...
Just for listeners, the Tulsa race massacre of Black Wall Street in Tulsa in the early 1900s. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
And I saw a gentleman, Rasan Ray, from the Brookings Institute, and he said that, you know, hate groups need to be classified as gangs to allow them to be investigated. And we need to take all of this into account. Lastly, Sandy Hook, I think about this and juxtapose.
School shooting.
Sandy Hook school shooting, 28 people were killed, but 20 white babies, 20 white babies who were 6 and 7 years old were killed, and nothing was done. So as a black person, when I look at black folk, and you see there was a video where he skipped over a white person, it really begs the question who we are, where we are, and how do we get out of this? And I would submit it is going to require white folks to step up and have very uncomfortable conversations and do what Joan did, not turn it off, but switch it on to have the conversations with people you disagree with and you have difficulties with.
So
we have to.
Joan, I'm going to come to you just to clarify a couple of things. The shooter wore some kind of a GoPro-style camera and was broadcasting on Twitch until it was quickly brought down. He shot 13 people. 11 of them were black. 10 died, just for our listeners who may not know that whole picture. Joan, you wanted to jump right in. Go ahead.
Well, what I wanted to respond to was speaking out. Yes, I think it's important, and I'm not going to try to speak for all white people here, but I feel there is a fear now of saying the wrong thing. And Tito, you sort of went down the list of what the wrong thing is. And I know it. Don't call him a teenager, you know, because a black 18-year-old would be called a black man, not a black teenager. Don't call him troubled, because a black 18-year-old who's involved in violence, we're not, white people don't see it as troubled. They see it as something different.
As violent.
I know, right. I know the code words, but I think that if you make people afraid of saying anything, then that's an incentive to say nothing. I also think that it's important to try to understand how troubled teenager internet leads to white supremacy. Maybe that's naive on my part that I don't get it. Maybe it's Pollyanna-ish of me to think that trying to understand it can somehow head it off or change it. But, I mean, that's kind of where I'm coming from in my sometimes reticence now to tackle a topic. I started out by saying I've started to feel maybe I'm not the right person to do it because I'm a white woman of a certain age and background. And maybe I shouldn't be discouraged from taking it on. The way to have change is to build coalitions, and that's what makes change happen.
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts there, and I'm going to bring it back to you, Tito. First, it does particularly strike me that white women of a certain age, and I'm entering that age myself, have a very specific conversation we should have here in this moment. And we can talk about the history of white women and black America and the roles we have and haven't played, but I think it behooves us to sit in the discomfort the way you did with the column. You know, I got a text from a really close friend on Monday saying, what are you going to do about this story? Not, are you covering it? But what are you going to do about this story? And of course, my first reaction was, we're Radio Boston. We stay very local. We're working very hard to be about our community. And then I realized our community needs to have this conversation. Our team realized that, which is why we are trying right here at this table to model a Boston conversation about something that happened in Buffalo. And that feels like sitting with that discomfort, especially white people who I think are not necessarily good at talking about race or versed in talking about race. It's time to take on that mantle of discomfort. And I know I'm opinionating more than I probably should, but this is us at our table together, Tito.
White supremacy is real. When you listen to replacement theory, you need to really listen to what folk are saying. And we're when you listen to what replacement theory is, which is saying basically all these brown folks are going to take over our country, to me, that's actually, it's even deeper than that because I actually look at it as genetic. When you listen to people from the Klan, they're talking about essentially white genetic annihilation based on the fact that there's quote-unquote race mixing, right? as well as the number of people of color that are being born. So it's
and just to note, there's history in the 20th century of those kinds of arguments. You're not pulling this out of nowhere. There's history there.
Right. And so we are reverting back to, and we've heard folks, particularly on Fox News, you know, really push these conversations. And so what I would say is it is absolutely critical at this time as a country that we have these conversations. I also feel like, and when we listen to, you know, really the attack on women with Roe v. Wade, but understand some of the premise of Roe v. Wade is the 14th Amendment, right? And that connectivity. And as a man, I have to step up and say that I believe it is right for a woman to have the right to choose. And that's how change happens. If white folks stand aside, and if someone as powerful as Joan Vernanke does not write and use what she's able to do and the ink that she's able to purvey in this, then we cannot and will not move forward as a country. And the question is, are we going to move forward or are we going to revert backward? And I would submit to you right now, a lot of the conversations that I'm having are conversations that are pulling us back rather than forward. When I see a 9-year-old kid with a video going to a black kid's door with a whip and whipping, there was a story, I believe this is in Texas, where there was a 9-year-old who went to their neighbor's house with a whip and was whipping the door of a black the home of a black child. These young people come from someplace. These are cultural cues, and they are being raised in this fashion. And so we have to have these conversations. We are in a country where people are trying to change textbooks, and to really push a specific mantra onto our children when it comes to social studies and history. We have to continue to have these conversations, and they result in outcomes such as Buffalo.
So, Joan, with Tito's words still ringing in our ears, one of the things that strikes me about your work over time is that you're good at saying, here's who needs to step up and how. As you think about after writing this piece and with the feedback you've gotten this week, are there individuals, institutions that have a particular opportunity or a particular responsibility to step forward here in Greater Boston in this moment, facilitate these conversations, participate in these conversations, create spaces for discomfort and stand in it? Have you thought about that?
I actually haven't thought about it from the Boston piece. I've thought about it, I guess, from more of a national platform. I mean, Tito mentioned Martin Luther King. I keep on listening for some voice. There are powerful local voices, of course. You know, Tito is one of them. There are many. I'm listening for a voice from on the national front that can get people from both sides to pay attention. I mean, that is the problem right now, right? We're kind of, I think conversations are great. We should have them. They're uncomfortable. They're painful. But we need to have them. But how do you get from the conversation to change? In 2008, which now seems like another century, I thought Barack Obama was that voice for the country. People in a moment in time listened to him. He got people from blue states, red states, to somehow believe they were purple states. We definitely are way past that, and I don't think he's the voice who could do it anymore. He did what he could. But so who is the next person? I don't know. I almost feel like it has to come from the so-called other side.
So I
would submit, and what I say to folks when it comes to running for elected office, if you don't see someone who represents the perspective that you you feel or need, you need to run for office yourself. And I would submit that this it is problematic, actually, to look for a MLK or a Gandhi. They're gone and they're dead. And typically, we look for those individuals. And our young people, I think, have done a better thing where it's broad-based. And we have to look at it not from the perspective of a leader, but leaders and a movement that changes things. When we look at the Arab Spring, they didn't have any one individual leader that toppled many of these countries. So what I would say to you is that this is not Democrat and Republican. This is white supremacy and those who stand idly by, either who step forward and fight it or those who stand idly by and acquiesce and are apathetic when it comes to it. And I would submit we have to have white leadership who gets off the bystander list and to step forward and have these conversations in coalition with people of color. We can't. This hurts. This is stressful this week. Seeing black bodies harmed does me physically harm. I've been calling my massage therapist all week, that is something that we as black folk also deal with. We're looked at oftentimes for leadership in these situations. We're tired. We're stressed out. And this is a huge burden to bear to see those bodies of us, a reflection of us on the ground, and then only to also have others not take up their proverbial cross and to do the work that needs to be done. So we should be looking within and not outside of ourselves to be the agents of change.
I hear you. And I guess I have two reactions. I mean, I don't go to a grocery store and think that somebody is going to hunt me down and kill me. So to grapple with what you're grappling with is outside my life experience. Historically in this country, there was a movement, the civil rights movement of the 60s, which I think did what you're talking about, mobilized black and white Americans towards a goal. And we don't want to, it does feel like someone's trying to turn the clock back. So how do we stop them? I wish I was smart enough to know the answer to that question, but I don't, I'm not.
I think I'm going to leave it there. And I appreciate both of you being at the table today to begin today's conversation from a news event that happened in Buffalo, but that we know is challenging us so deeply here in our greater Boston community. And I feel real gratitude. The last voice you heard was Joan Vanacki, associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. You can find a link to her piece on the Buffalo shooting at our website, radioboston.org, and Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, CEO and founder of Apex Noir Cannabis, and as of yesterday, an inaugural member of a commission he's been trying for years, Boston's Commission on Black Men and Boys. Thanks, both of you, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.